Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, where every 7 days we don our finest Saturday Night Fever suits and dance our way through the latest happenings in the technology world. My name's Bobby Johnson and I'll be doing my best John Travolta impression as I stand in once again for Boogie Queen Alex Kwiatkowski. In the week that Lily Allen became the latest musician to weigh in on the copyright debate, we're going to take a look at the future of the system with Joey Ito, the chief executive of Creative Commons.
I think mobile is globally one of the areas that has significant growth in revenue for a lot of players.
And we'll also revisit the 1970s by hearing about a new TV program that turns back the technological clock and looks at how life has changed over the last 40 years.
It's the decade of the gadget.
Playing with the world's biggest remote control.
Software and hardware just changed constantly.
Wow, what a big telly.
Only 19 years ago there was only 4 channels and now we have you can get 600 or something.
Not enough? Then we'll also be dousing you with a splash of this week's news headlines and taking a Bee Gees inspired walk through your feedback. So comb your hair and put on your disco shoes. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It seems that barely a day goes by without some sort of copyright row hitting the headlines, whether it's to do with YouTube, Scribd.com, the Pirate Bay, or some other argument about unauthorized file sharing. Amid the maelstrom, Creative Commons is an organization that hopes to end many of those complaints by offering a variety of levels of copyright that exist between the traditional copyrighted or uncopyrighted status. Its variety of alternative licenses allow creators and artists to let people share, reuse or remix their work freely, rather than face the simple binary that the status quo provides at the moment. Now, the Creative Commons movement has gained some momentum in recent years, and earlier this week, the organisation's chief executive, Japanese entrepreneur and investor Joey Ito, dropped by to talk about what's happening. Charles Arthur started by asking him which countries have been the most interested in taking up Creative Commons licenses.
So Creative Commons is a tool that is built on top of copyright. So in order for Creative Commons to exist, copyright has to exist. And in fact, in countries where they have very little or no copyright enforcement, we're actually not that interesting. And Creative Commons is the most interesting in regimes where copyright is very complicated, yet some people want to share. And then Creative Commons becomes a very important tool. So in fact, in places where it's difficult. So we're really a solution for failed sharing that fails because it's difficult for people, for professors to share courseware, for students to do work together, for musicians to collaborate. And we provide a tool to help you do that.
You were an early investor in Flickr, and Flickr is perhaps one of the biggest examples of the use of Creative Commons, isn't it?
Yes, they have over 100 million Creative Commons images.
Has that success at Flickr been translated into an understanding of what Creative Commons is about, do you think?
I think it's been hugely important. I think it has created a dialogue. It's created a great deal of understanding of the 250,000 or so licenses. Of them, 100 million are Flickr. So that's huge. But not included in that 250 million right now is actually Wikipedia, which just several months ago has converted to a Creative Commons license. And I think everyone sort of understands Wikipedia. So Flickr, I think, was the first and most important user of Creative Commons. But now we've got the White House, Ridley Scott, Al Jazeera, Gwen Stefani, all kinds of people using, and Trent Reznor using Creative Commons. So I think it's starting to ripple out. But yes, Flickr, I think, was the most important initial user.
What's different about the way that musicians are using Creative Commons? You mentioned a number there, about the way that they're using it compared to, say, the way that photographers or other people would use it.
So we have a whole range of licenses. We have 6 basic licenses, ranging from just give me attribution, you can do what I want, to you can't create derivatives, you can't use it commercially. It really depends on who you are. So we don't tell people what they should want to express. What we want to do is, if you're a professional musician, we want to help you express the kind of copyright license that you want, technically and legally, very easily and clearly. So typically, professional musicians will choose a license that prohibits commercial reuse to protect their income, which usually comes in from copyright. Not always the case. But for instance, a photographer, especially an amateur photographer, may say, well, what I want is I want to be well known, so I focus on attribution. Documentary producers often use a no derivatives license because they don't want the story to change, but there maybe their point is to tell the story, so they'll allow it to allow commercial use. So for instance, that a movie theater could show the movie. So it really depends on the use. I think that educators, for instance, are by and large, you know, encouraged to use just attribution because, for instance, you know, it's very important to allow textbook manufacturers in developing nations, for instance, to reprint the educational material for it to finish its path. Different categories of people use different licenses for different reasons.
One question that's come up, I think, about Creative Commons is whether the licenses have ever been tested in court and shown to actually have a legal standing. Can you update us on what the status is there?
Yeah, so first of all, these sorts of licenses in general, these free licenses or things like artistic licenses and things, and that was actually tested in court, not the Creative Commons license, but a very similar license in the U.S. Federal Appeals Court last year, decided that breaching a license is actually a breach of copyright. And so you become a copyright infringer if you don't follow the stipulations in the license. So that was a huge win for us. So now we don't have to worry about this whole discussion about whether there's a contract or not. And then specifically, we've had, I think, one of the most well-known cases is Adam Curry, the former MTV DJ, sued a publication in the Netherlands for not providing attribution, and he won using a Creative Commons license. And there are others. And we hope that you don't have to go to court. And we depend a lot on the community and the normative part to be the thing that helps people conform to the licenses.
On another tack, you're a venture capitalist. You were an early investor in Last.fm. You're an early investor in Twitter. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are interested by Twitter, especially at the moment. It's rumored that it's going to get some extra investment.
Yes, there is that rumor.
Is it true?
I can't really say. I can't speak on behalf of Twitter, but...
And the other question that keeps on hanging over Twitter is, how is it going to monetize itself? How is it going to start making money back? Mm-hmm. What is your understanding of what the plans are there?
I can speak sort of generally about internet companies. Almost all the companies that I've invested in that have failed or that I see fail have business models, have great products, have pretty good teams, but they have no users. Getting users, getting distribution, getting attention, becoming viral, that's the single most difficult thing on the internet to do. And just about every product fails because they don't have any users. And the entrepreneurs tend not to focus on that. There are very few companies that have been able to get to tens of millions of users that have failed, other than for being sued or some other reason like that. So the other thing is that the people who would pay you for things like carriers or big companies typically don't want to talk to you until you have tens of millions of users. If you have 1,000 users and you go to British Telecom and you say, I want to come up with a business model with you guys, they're not going to sit at the table with you. And so the focus on user growth initially may sound like a sort of, you know, internet bubble era way of thinking about things. But if you think about statistically what's successful and what's not, that is usually the successful thing, is to focus on the virality and the user growth. Once you have that, what you look at is you look at, okay, well, who are we benefiting? Right. So when Twitter grows, well, SMS usage goes up. Sites are now able to promote across friends' networks. You know, traffic to certain kinds of sites increase. And there, so and then you can search and use Twitter traffic for doing search. People can sell, they can tell stories. And so there are a lot of things that Twitter enables. And then as a normal internet company would look at, okay, well, who's benefiting the most in this value chain? Where is there the least friction to get paid? Then how do we come up with a business model? And so Twitter has a bunch of very smart biz dev people right now thinking about all the various things. In Japan, we're actually doing a lot of experimentation. We're running advertising on Twitter in Japan. We have a Twitter portal, and we're talking to a variety of different partners. I mean, so there's little bits of monetization experimentation going on right now, but I can't say for sure what's going to be the big thing.
Which part of the value chain does have that money that can be most easily moved into Twitter's coffers?
It's pretty hard to say, but I will say that I think mobile is globally one of the areas that has significant growth in revenue for a lot of players. If you look at Japan, the companies that are growing are the companies that, you know, the mobile companies, you know, selling hundreds of millions of dollars each on avatars for mobile phones, you know, and ringtones and all these, and games. And so I think, you know, mobile will be an important part of the strategy.
Would that be the mobile user or the mobile network paying Twitter?
That I can't say for sure. I think it depends because we're benefiting both of them. But if you have the users and the traffic, I think that you can experiment and iterate and usually figure out a way to make some money. Not always, but usually. So I dodged your question. I'm not sure.
That was Joey Ito, the chief executive of Creative Commons, talking to Charles Arthur. And you can find out more about the project at creativecommons.org. Now, while there's plenty to chew over there, let's get on with the show and hear this week's top news headlines.
Prominent British musicians are divided over government plans to cut off internet connections belonging to file sharers. On the one hand, artists including Elton John, James Blunt, and Lily Allen are backing the plan, suggesting that it's the only way to prevent illegal downloading, while a coalition featuring Annie Lennox, Billy Bragg, Tom Jones and others say threatening fans is not going to solve the problem. The European Commission has backed up its decision to fine Intel €1 billion by releasing documents showing how the company had abused its marketing power to stifle competition. The dossier included emails showing how the chipmaker had offered discounts and payments to companies on the condition they avoided using technology from Intel's rival AMD. Controversial online advertising company Form has suffered further blows this week, including the loss of its chief technology officer and director of corporate communications. The firm also shut down a website it built to campaign against its critics and revealed it had lost more than £9 million in the last 6 months. And finally, the latest famous face to join the iPhone app craze is none other than British TV presenter Noel Edmonds. For £1.19, owners of Apple's handset can buy a program that allows them to take part in cosmic ordering, the pseudo-spiritual belief that Edmonds says is responsible for getting him back on TV screens.
Thanks for that, and if you want to catch up on any of the latest news, just visit guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, as promised, we're going to take a dive into a new BBC programme, Electric Dreams, that looks at the way technology has influenced our lives in recent years.
The Sullivan Barneses are taking part in a unique experiment. They've been stripped of all their modern technology, including 3 games consoles, 3 DVD players, 5 mobile phones, 6 televisions and 7 computers.
Be fantastic at the end of it if we're slightly less hooked on all the techno stuff.
Their own home has been turned into a time machine.
What on earth have they done with our kitchen?
What do you think of the telescope?
Black and white!
Why can't you be more patient?
Nothing ever works.
It's embarrassing. It just makes it look like we've spent our entire time watching television.
But as the gadgets come thick and fast...
We've got a new one there.
Oh, blimey, not another one.
What price family life?
Hamish won't speak to us again, because he won't need to.
Shoot! Oh!
Has progress always been for the better? And how has it changed our electric dreams?
We'll always be together. The show, which is coming to BBC Four at the end of the month, is... well, it's kind of hard to explain. Fortunately, though, presenter Gia Milinovic and producer Kate Hall came into Guardian Towers to tell us more. Over to Charles.
So, pull out your handheld computer and connect over the Wi-Fi or your mobile network to your hard drive personal video recorder at home and make sure that you set it for BBC Four next Tuesday, 29th of September at 9 o'clock, because that is when the first episode of Electric Dreams airs. And all those things, the handheld computer, the Wi-Fi, the 3G, the network, the mobile, the handheld video recorder, all those sorts of things, weren't available to the people in the programme because they have been cast back to the year of 1970. Tell us about the idea behind this programme.
What we wanted to do was look at the impact of the last 40 years of technological change on the British home and on the British family unit. And so we found a wonderful family who agreed to be taken back in time. We start in 1970. They very kindly agreed to let us take their house back as well. So all their mod cons were stripped out. There was a lot of interesting wallpaper and furniture. And I think in terms of technology, it's a bit of a wilderness, really. There's one television, black and white, one telephone, and that's a dial telephone in the hallway, and not a lot else, really.
And you even took the content on the television back to 1970.
Absolutely, yes.
And then you roll forward a day at a time, so it's a year a day for each of these developments.
Yes, all the way through the 80s and the 1990s.
Now, Gia Milinovic was the tech expert. Gia, you had to, source all the technology for it?
Yes, my area was computers, the internet, things like that. So the 1970s was a bit boring for me.
You basically had nothing to do.
I got a calculator, I think, because I remember it, a Sinclair Cambridge calculator. The 80s got more exciting, and the 90s were quite busy. Sometimes we introduced things a bit earlier. Sometimes just because they were desperate for it, like the internet, for example. They were really, really desperate for it. So I think we introduced that in 1997, and I'm not sure of the statistics, but I don't think 50% of the country had it at home in 97. So we got it to them then, and we gave them the internet circa 1997 as well.
How did you source all this stuff? I mean, did you have to go into vast vaults of sort of thrown away Commodore 64s and Dragon 32s? And
yes, it was amazing and so exciting. When we started, every single sourcing package that we did, we'd go, oh, I remember that. We had one of those. Oh my God, I want one of those. And so everyone was kind of very excited about all of the technology they had when they were kids, which included games or computers or just everything. You'd walk into these museums, the computer museum, and I saw a Merlin. Do you remember Merlins?
Very
games
vaguely.
From the 1980s. And I was so excited. I had to go through all my photographs and find the picture of my sister at Christmas time opening her Merlin.
What's the thing you're most proud of having sourced and found?
Gosh. For me, the coolest one was actually giving them the internet circa 1997. Just because I'm really into the web. So that was a feat, but that was from the Internet Archive. So they have a very secret place that you can go and they serve you up the internet based on a particular year. So they started archiving the web in 96. Sorry, that's my son squeaking. So yeah, we gave them the internet in 97. So for me, that was the coolest thing. What about you, Kate?
The tea's made. Because I think it really just, when we opened up the box, just seeing the teas made and seeing the leaflet from Goblin, it was a blast from the past. It was just fab, and the family absolutely loved it.
And what about the social side? Because you said all the family had to stay together in the 70s because there was only the one television. As things move forward into the 90s and you start to have games consoles and the kids can sort of move off to their bedrooms, what sort of change did that bring to the family socially?
They were very shocked because as soon as they headed into the 90s, it really did just split them up. Games consoles meant that the children could go off into their bedrooms. Bedroom culture arrived as soon as 1990 began, really. Yes, I think they were just really surprised at how much technology occupied them individually within the same house. I think it was a lesson in terms of the way that they now live, because they're a very techie family and they're really into their technology. And I think it made them realise that they did actually want a space within their home where they would spend time together, because they really don't. And that was something that Georgie, the mum, really, really wanted to kind of show the kids, that it was possible to spend time together. And that's why she wanted to take them back to the 1970s.
There was also a gender divide, wasn't there, that came over pretty strongly?
In the 80s, we started to see it, didn't we?
Yeah, I was really interested by that, actually, because they worried about that at the time during the 80s, that girls weren't connecting with computers and weren't interested in programming computers, because, of course, you had to know how to program a computer if you wanted to use one in the 80s. And I was quite surprised to see that that was the case. The girls were not interested, and that includes mum as well. But the boys just loved it, absolutely loved having to type in all that code and download tapes.
George Cox, who's our youngest guest here, is having his say about it.
Yeah.
The arrival of the computers, of course, there was all the British computers. They come and they go really quite quickly in the scheme of things. Why did British computing not manage to survive the course?
I think the problem was that they weren't compatible with one another. And so it was very easy for the smaller brands to just fall by the wayside as everyone picked up. The big two, I suppose, were Sinclair Spectrum and the BBC Micro before we got IBM, Microsoft and all that stuff. It was an amazing time, actually, in the UK. There were so many different makes. And when I went to the computer museum and just saw these ones that, as an American, I'd never heard of the Dragon, a Welsh-made one. That was brilliant. It was so exciting to see these things. And a shame, really, that that's all just gone by the wayside now. It's just software now.
So if you had to choose, each of you individually, one thing that you think really made a difference to the family out of the 30 years that you cover there, which do you think it would be? The freezer, the microwave, the computer?
I was going to say the freezer.
The freezer. Because for Georgie, who had all the 1970s home gadgets, like a twin tub and a tiny little fridge, and, you know, four children to look after, and she works nearly full time, the arrival of the freezer made such a massive difference. And it meant that she could get in the car in the Cortina, go to the supermarket itself, a fairly new thing in the 1970s, and stock up enough food for the whole week. And it was easier to prepare because she could just pop it in the oven. I think she herself says she's slightly ashamed of the massive difference that a freezer made to her life.
Yeah.
But the freezer was definitely a biggie.
I think the funniest touch in the kitchen was, alongside all of the recipe books, was a copy of The Female Eunuch as well in the 1970s.
Yes.
So, yeah, bizarrely, the freezer was the most interesting, I think.
That was Charles Arthur speaking to Kate Hall and Gia Milinovic about the forthcoming BBC 4 series Electric Dreams, which starts on September the 29th. Well, that was a taste of technology from the past 40 years, but let's take a look at some more recent history in the shape of your comments after last week's show. Over on the blog, Welsh Champ had a few thoughts after we discussed online bank security, in particular problems caused by using a UK bank account while living in another country. The software might be clever, but it's using a hammer to crack a nut, they say. And explain a situation in which they can withdraw money from a European cash machine, a US military cash machine, and buy something on Amazon UK, which ends up with their card being blocked because it ends up looking like it's being used in three different countries at once. The comment carries on, discussing the situation, and points out that banks, they just can't understand this and ask them to pop into the local branch. I can't pop into my local branch. I live in Germany, he or she says. Surely not everybody's out there laundering money. Well, I feel your pain, Welsh Champ. I've experienced exactly the same sort of thing here in San Francisco. And it's pretty apparent that while banks seem like they're getting smarter, perhaps they've still got a long way to go in understanding how people really use their accounts. Anyway, enough of the money talk. Over on Twitter, there are a few comments, including one from John Hickman, who said he listens to the show while cooking. Nice one, John, same here. And a plea from MT Hall, who said, as much as Charles and I have been doing a great job, thank you very much, I hope Alex Kay will be back on Guardian Tech Weekly soon. Don't worry, Matthew, so do we. And having finally written up her PhD, Alex is currently travelling around the globe for her own BBC TV series. Now, that's very exciting, but I'm going to let her tell you about it when she next clambers back into the hot seat, which should be very soon. Anyway, if you've got anything to say about this week's show, then do drop us a line in the comments box at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. That's where you can also find links to our Twitter page and our Facebook group. We really appreciate your comments and try to read out as many as we can, so tell us what you think. That's it for this week, I think, actually. So all that's left for me to say is to thank our guests, Joey Ito, Gia Milinovic and Kate Hall, and the talents of our own Charles Arthur, of course. This week we've had not one but two producers in the shape of Ian Chambers and Andy Duckworth. Thanks very much, chaps. And my name's Bobby Johnson. Thank you for listening and see you next Tuesday.